Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, welcome to After the Jump. I'm your host, Grace Bonney, and today we're coming to you live from Roberto's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. You can listen to the show live every Thursday at 11 on heritageradionetwork.org or download the podcast on iTunes. Today, my guest is someone who is very close to my heart and thankfully, literally close to me as well today. That makes me happy because she lives in Rome and we only get to see her once or twice a year at the most. And that person is Christina Gill, photographer, foodie, and for the past 6 years, the food and drink editor of Design Sponge. I feel like I have known Christina my whole life, but I only get to see her a few times a year. So it's a real treat and honor to interview her on the show today. So Christina, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I just realized I was going to try to say like welcome in Italian. I don't know any Italian.
Benvenuta.
It's so much prettier when you say it. So you have like the world's most fascinating life to me, which I know you constantly think you don't have, but I think you do. You have traveled so much and you have such an interesting background and career. So I want to start at the beginning. Tell everybody listening a little bit about where you grew up.
I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, and I basically left home when I was 18. I did my undergraduate at Stanford. When I left Nashville, country music was country music. It wasn't crossover. It was pretty much AM radio. and then from California, I went to graduate school in Washington and Bologna, then back to Washington. I was in the Foreign Service. Then I moved to Italy.
You jumped ahead so fast. Wait, I want to go backwards.
That's because my life in Nashville was kind of uneventful.
Uneventful. What was your family like? And do you have any siblings?
I have two brothers. I grew up with, it was just basically my father and my two brothers. And we're from the South, so pretty typical black family from the South. My grandmother is in Huntsville, Alabama. So I spent the summers in Huntsville, what I like to refer to as indentured servitude, picking the fruit off of the fruit trees in her garden because she had her vegetable garden. She had her fruit trees. I found out a couple years ago, before I was born, they also had chickens and small animals. Huh. Well, I shouldn't say small animals. They definitely had chickens. I don't think they had any livestock. and that was it. So the summers was going there, getting in the grapevine, getting the grapes, getting chased by wasps, bees, and preparing all the fruit to make preserves. And she had her frozen vegetables, her succotash, her preserves, and everything.
Succotash. You know you're from the South when you can reference succotash. I've said that before in New York, and people look at me like I'm from a different country. And I'm like, lima beans and corn, people. It's delicious.
It'll be trending soon.
Exactly. What did you think you were going to be when you were growing up?
I have no idea. I think there was a time. How far back?
I don't know. As far back as you can remember.
I don't really, I've probably like removed that memory from my brain, but my closest memory was wanting to someday be Secretary of State, and then that kind of fell off.
Well, you carried that a little bit. Let's talk about where you went to college. You went to Stanford. How did you choose Stanford, and what did you want to study when you were there?
I chose Stanford because I had applied to Georgetown School of Foreign Service. I was evaluating financial aid packages. So, evaluating the financial aid packages, I decided that at the end, if the packages were the same, I wanted to be able to go to a school that was good all around and not just, you know, foreign service. And I chose Stanford and never looked back. And I think that was the right decision for many reasons, but, also because if your life is oriented on the East Coast, you don't often make it to the West Coast.
Yeah.
So I appreciated spending the 3 years in California because 1 year I spent in Florence. So
So is that where you sort of got your first taste of, like, Italy and maybe wanting to go back?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I studied German from the seventh grade all the way through until I think everybody has has one of these stories. I was studying German, and I had a neighbor in the dorm I was staying in who was German, who would correct my homework with the grammar book, and I would still get C's on the work, and I couldn't understand it, and he would scratch his head. He said, you know, we've got the grammar book. I'm a native German speaker. I'm not a dumb German speaker, and I don't understand what's wrong. And the German teacher had just decided I was never going to do anything in her class. And she said, well, you're never going to be any good at this. So I started putting more effort into Italian, and that was it. I mean, I still kind of flip through German things and listen to German things periodically, but that was it.
That's pretty impressive. So you made, for those people listening, Christina's been in Italy for 14 years now?
14
which is a long time. So how did you make that transition to Italy? You went to school in Bologna, right? So how did that happen?
I did a year, my first year of graduate school in Bologna at the School of Advanced International Studies. I went back to Washington, and I joined the Foreign Service when I finished the master's program. And I did my first tour in Washington. And my second tour was in Rome. And so I was in Rome for 3 years, and I resigned from the Foreign Service after that. And that's almost the modern age.
So wait, so your husband, Nicolo, is Italian. Did you meet him
after.
Then? After there. Okay. Because I've always wondered, I never really put those two things together, which one actually brought you back to Italy and kept you there.
That's another story for another day. But yeah, he says I just wore him down, but I did meet him. My apartment where I was staying was around the corner from where I work, so I walked past every day, and I just I saw him, and just for fun, because, you know, I have this type of personality, just go and say, will you go out with me tonight? And he'd say, no. Will you go out with me tomorrow night? No. Will you go out with me the night after that? No. Until finally, after, I don't know, 3 months of doing that every day, he just said, all right, fine, I'll go out with you. And I guess until the time we got married, I guess we saw each other every day after that. So,
oh my God, I didn't know that.
I know. So I tell people, if you really like somebody, persevere.
I love it. So I love that you have this really, like, both intense and really beautiful relationship with food in general. And people who know you through Design Sponge know you through, like, recipes and introducing us to great chefs and cookbooks. But you also, that's a big thing that ties into your work, which deals with sort of world hunger and food assistance. Tell people a little bit about the work you do there, because I think that work is fascinating as well as incredibly important.
So I work during the week. The bulk of my work week is with one of the top government donors to the UN World Food Program. The World Food Program deals with the bottom 10%. So the 10% neediest, the 10% of the 10% of the most needy, hungry people. And we are basically the people who do the job that I do, which is an advisor, food security advisor, basically look at the programming of the organization to make sure that they have the administrative policies in place, the financial structure in place, and the programming to get the food to the people in the time that it needs to be done. And it is difficult sometimes to come home and to look at the fun side of food, which is, you know, okay, I'm going to take a picture of this. I'm going to go to the supermarket. I'm going to buy, I shouldn't say supermarket here, should I? I'm going to go to the farm down the street. Because actually, truly, I do buy my food at a farm. I'm going to go to the farm down the street, and I'm going to buy, you know, 5 pounds of ground beef so that I can make one perfect hamburger so that I can take a picture of it. And it really is a buzzkill when you start to think about, during the week, you're looking at figures of hundreds of millions of people who really don't have enough to eat. And we can afford to eat pizza at Roberta's or go somewhere, and other people just really, they can't.
Does that affect the sort of your interest level in what you're covering or the types of food that we're covering on the site or that you're photographing elsewhere? Or is photography of that sort of food kind of a mental break from the reality that you're dealing with at work?
It is a mental break, because when you're dealing with these figures, you're looking, the situations, the high priority situations, you're looking at South Sudan, North Korea, The Horn of Africa 2 years ago had the famine. Syria, which is even more difficult because it's civil war. The Sahel, where they're having huge problems in Mali. It really is depressing because you realize that as a single person, you can never, ever, ever, ever affect a change. It is many people getting together to do something. And you always want to help. And there's really, even if you had, I can't say if you had the most money in the world, but even, you know, if I were Bill Gates, he's doing great things. That money can influence things. I'm never going to be a billionaire. Never say never. but I don't see it on my horizon. And so you do feel kind of helpless and depressed a lot. So then it is fun to go do the sticky buns and the, you know, all the great recipes on Design Sponge. And we do at our house eat every single thing that we make. We don't believe in wasting food, so it's a good opportunity also to eat new things. But mm-hmm. yeah, it is an escape from the cold, hard reality of world hunger.
So where do you think your sort of first little seed of loving food so much came from? Is that something that comes from growing up in the South, or do you think that's something you developed as you grew older?
I ask myself that all the time. I don't know, because if I look at what I like to eat today with compared with what I like to eat 20 years ago, I am only 25, by the way, but 20 years ago or even 30 years ago, it's completely different. So tastes evolve over time. I can't even describe it. I guess I'm pretty normal in the sense that when you taste something you like, you'd like to eat more of it. And I meet people sometimes who are not enthusiastic about food, or they forget to eat, and I think they're aliens, because I just don't understand how people can't, you know, sleep, food, my two favorite things. I don't understand how people can't really be interested, not obsessed, but just interested in food, even as it tastes. So I don't know. I guess it's always been there wanting. Some people discover things visually. I like to discover things through my palate. So if I go to, you know, Turkey, I want to taste the food there and get into the sociocultural part of the food and why people eat a certain way. But that's a continual evolution.
Mm-hmm. What's your most nostalgic food? What's the food that if you eat, you instantly kind of have a past memory pop up? I read an interview where you said that you were eating baked potatoes with A1 steak sauce was a strong one for you.
Oh yeah, that one was a horrible one. I won't eat, it was Heinz 57.
Oh, Heinz 57.
Yeah, I won't eat Heinz 57. Nostalgia, I don't know. For me, like the hamburger is the thing for me. Always, always, always hamburgers. I don't necessarily know if it's nostalgia, but it's just a good hamburger is just the sign to me that everything is right in my world at that point, and I can fix everything with a good hamburger.
What's your ideal hamburger have on it?
Nothing.
Nothing.
I'm a purist. Now I went to I eat the bacon cheeseburger at the Little Owl.
Oh, okay. We can't go wrong there.
I think it's one of the best ever, and I convert people little by little to go there. When you come to New York, go to Little Owl and have that bacon cheeseburger. But generally I take a plain rare with ketchup. That's it.
Rare. Okay, what kind of bun?
I'm not big into the toasting. If you can toast it just on one side.
Yeah.
That's it. A plain bun. No fancy buns, no seeds, no onions, no.
I like plain. It. I feel like we need to get you a hamburger after this interview. we're going to take a really quick break, and we'll be right back with Christina Gill.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Washed rind cheeses are a fairly recent addition to the repertoires of artisanal cheesemakers in the United States. These cheeses tend to be stinkier than other types and are often high on the list of connoisseurs. Now, Whole Foods Market has come up with one of their own. The raw cow's milk cheese made by Sprout Creek Farm in Poughkeepsie, New York, is washed with 6-point ale from Red Hook, Brooklyn. The beige sticky rind deepens in color as it ages. The satiny ivory cheese within is mellow with a sweetly tangy bite and a grassy aroma. The current version features 6-point diesel, which is in limited supply, so stop by and pick up some before it's gone. And Point of Origin cheese is sold exclusively at Whole Foods Market in New York, Northern New Jersey, and Connecticut. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com. You know HeritageRadioNetwork.org is a member-supported nonprofit organization. If you like what you're listening to, go to our website and click that donate button. Become a member and get special discounts, invites, VIP treatment, t-shirts, and more. Support us in our mission to bring you the freshest food content in the nation.
Hey, welcome back to After the Jump. I'm your host, Grace Bonney, and today I'm here with photographer Christina Gill, who's also the food and drink editor at Design Sponge. Before the break, we were talking about Christina's really fascinating history and sort of current work experience and sort of the world hunger realm. And I want to sort of move things over to photography now, because that's such a huge part of what you do, both for us and then everything else you do. How did you first get interested in photography?
I got interested in photography personally because I was doing my blog, which is defunct, but I'm going to resurrect it, threelayercake.com. And I wanted to have nice photos. And so I could never use a point and shoot camera because I shake too much and all my pictures were blurry. So I had to get a digital SLR with some pretty fast lenses. And it all took off from there. Then we started doing the In the Kitchen with Column. We needed to try as much as possible to have, you know, a site aesthetic. And taking that in-house and doing it in-house was just easier to ensure a look on the site. And it's just been, it just took off from there.
I love that the first post you ever did for Design Sponge was Camilla Engman's Beets with Feta Cheese. And I loved that one because it was the first time we played around with really trying to integrate a designer's personal style. And it was images of beets that had like little illustrations that made them look like human beings or like little characters. And it was always so fun. And I think from there, the column has really grown. For people who aren't familiar with In the Kitchen With, which is Christina's food column on Design Sponge, how would you describe sort of the evolution of from that very first post to where we are now?
When we started out, we really wanted to get the designers and what they like to cook in the kitchen. And since then, we've kind of moved from a strictly designer sense to creative professionals and food professionals. I think interest in food, as much as I hate to say this, interest in food has really grown since then. So it's much easier to find people who are really willing to share their favorite recipe. As before, it was not that easy. Not that people, people are really come looking for us now, and we were looking for them before. And the column really, when it started out, was a lot of cupcakes.
we had a real baked good problem for a while.
A lot of cupcakes and a lot of really simple foods. And since then, I've really tried to move it into something that's more that's not just American, so that it's anything. We were vegetarian before, and we do meat on the column now. We don't do a lot of meat, but we definitely do meat. We've done fish, on the column. So I'm just trying to move it into just really what people would eat without any restrictions.
What's the hardest part of your job at Design Sponge?
The hardest part really is keeping the content going. Sometimes, you know, we have recipes that come through which might not necessarily be appealing, and appealing not in a food sense, but in a picture sense. Lasagna, for example, we had with Brian Malarkey, that was really hard to do. Cookies are always hard to do because they're flat. But that is really the hardest part, is to try to get something that doesn't look the exact same every single week, and to try to shake it up. And I think one thing that I'm pretty happy about is we really, really try not to repeat recipes. So we might have a couple of chocolate cakes. But I really have a rule, not a hard, fast rule, but it's pretty hard, that we don't do anything we've ever done before. So we really have a lot of variety on the column, and that's hard as well, because you can imagine, I mean, food is food, and there's a lot of repetition.
Yeah. One of the things I think I'm most appreciative of that you do, and I think you do this naturally, is you're always setting the bar higher, and you're trying to expose people to things that people in other cultures would eat, or that may seem unexpected to us, or maybe not as in vogue as other things, but things that are important to be exposed to, and you always really stand by it. I'm thinking particularly of the rabbit recipe that we ran a few months back from, do you remember an Australian chef? Do you remember who the chef was?
Rowan Anderson, I think that's his last name.
Is probably behind us. And I remember he had a rabbit recipe, and it was a sort of, he'd caught it himself, and that was something, and there was a huge comment sort of brouhaha from people who were like, that's my pet, I can't believe you cooked my pet, and you didn't say anything at first, and then people started to chime in who are from Australia or from other countries where rabbit is not only a very popular and normal thing to eat, but it was also something that was sort of a nuisance in terms of being a pest, almost like rats or other things like that. There's so many of them that population growth had to be under control. And it became this really interesting learning lesson for people who were from the U.S. and were not aware of the way other people's food population was sort of working and what animals were issues and not. And it was really, I love that you sort of put that out there and stood by it.
I like rabbit. but that's not the reason that I chose the recipe. The reason that I was happy to choose the recipe from the ones that he pitched was because we talk a lot about sustainability, you know, natural everything, and he's really the epitome of someone who raises or hunts or, you know, everything he's completely self-sustaining. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really the truest form of food that we could get on the column. And so I was happy to stand by it because he didn't go to the supermarket and buy the rabbit. He caught the rabbit and prepped the rabbit and grew the asparagus and cured his own ham. So I thought that was really good. And I do stand by that. I mean, I probably would never put a recipe for grasshoppers on on the column, though I could say if someone else had some really beautiful photography of some chocolate dipped insect, I'd consider it. But yeah, I do like to, if there's something holistic about it, then I'm happy to put it on the column.
That the insects takes me in my next question really perfectly. What's been the biggest flop that you've had so far? Now, it doesn't have to be something that was published, but something maybe that you tried to cook or wanted to do, but that just was a total nightmare when you tried to cook it.
Well, it was something that was really difficult for me on the column, and I think I alluded to this a couple of weeks ago, were the rum babas that we had.
Oh, yeah.
Because you see the rum babas look like mushrooms, you know, they puff up, and I could not make, and this, even the pictures you see on the site, they're not puffed up, and I bought three or four different kinds of baba molds, silicone molds, individual molds, bigger molds, smaller molds. I went to the pastry shops. I talked to the pastry makers, said, what do I have to do? I can never get them to poof at the top. And what you see on the site is the seventh try.
Oh, God.
And so, I mean, really, when I'm doing this stuff on the column, we do have a lot of contact with the authors when there are issues. Rachel Koo, for example, her cake, for me, I think I had to make it two times. And every time I had a problem, she went back into the kitchen and she made the cake to walk me through it. So this is, I say, I'm someone of average capability in the kitchen. I've never had any schooling. And I kind of use myself as a litmus test. Okay, I'm good at following a recipe, but I don't have any special skills. So if I'm having problem at this point, then I can presume that our readers might also have problems at that point too. And those two things, for example, and I think Kate Flame's pasta, absorption method pasta.
I remember that.
That was difficult too. I think I did that three times before I could get it. That was really from a photographic point of view because the food tasted fine, but I couldn't get it the way that she thought that it looked when she had it. And so that was really pretty labor intensive and a lot of asparagus. We had a lot of pasta for days at home for that.
I want to talk about meals as sort of an overall idea. What is your ideal meal? Describe where it would be, what you would eat, and who would be there with you. And this can be completely fanciful. You can invite people that are no longer living.
Oh, that's an interesting question. Something I've never really thought about. I think my meal, because I'm so obsessed with Australia, would definitely be in Sydney. All of my Australian friends would be there. You know, Matt from Matt Bites would be there because he...
That's fabulous.
Yes.
can you please bring Matt's dogs?
Oh, his dogs? Yeah, if they could get past the quarantine. I guess maybe all of my friends. And I guess I'm trying to think of if there's somebody famous. Oh, yes, I just have to put that out there. Peter Gabriel. I've really wanted to meet Peter Gabriel forever. Peter Gabriel, if you're listening.
Head of the table.
I really would like for Peter Gabriel to be there. I was obsessed with Quincy Jones. I met Quincy, so I can scratch that off my list. but really, it's about friends and people I know. I probably wouldn't choose that experience to meet somebody I didn't know.
What would you want to eat with them?
If I were in Australia and I had like limitless capacity to eat, I would start with an egg and bacon roll. Can this meal last all day from the morning?
Yeah, why not?
Egg and bacon roll. I would have a chicken schnitzel, and then I would go into all the Asian food.
Ooh.
Yeah, so I would have Thai food. I would have Vietnamese food. Everything.
That sounds good. I'm going to try to like weasel my way into that dream dinner if it ever happens. What's your favorite ingredient or your favorite cooking tool?
The tool that makes my life easiest, especially in the winter, is a pressure cooker. I don't own a microwave.
I don't either. Yay!
Yes, I don't believe in microwaves. I don't have the counter space for a microwave. So the pressure cooker really does help, especially in the winter. My favorite ingredient, probably what I eat most, is zucchini, and I eat zucchini out of season. I eat zucchini 52 weeks a year because I love them so much.
Who are some of the food photographers that inspire you or that you love the most?
Matt, obviously, is one of them because I think Matt is a color genius, and he gets it right every time. Alan Benson is an Australian photographer who does amazing things with light, very good with light. Michael Graydon is another person who really masters light well. I'm going to maul her name when I say this, so excuse me in advance, but Ditta Isaker.
She's Australian as well, right?
No, she's Danish.
Oh, I thought she was Australian.
No, she's Danish, and I really, really, really like her photography. Chris Terry is a photographer. He's a British photographer who's good at everything that he does. So he does portraits, he does food, and that's, it's not common that you find people that really work across all areas that mm-hmm. way. Those are really some of the photographers whose work I really like, and I just always get magazines. I'm willing to look at, you know, buy anything, try anything once, and I'm always visiting photography exhibitions, photography galleries. There's a South African photographer named Jody, I don't know how she pronounces it. I pronounce it Bieber because it's spelled the same way as Justin's last name. And she's done some really interesting work in South African Soweto, and that I thought was interesting. So I also look across the different styles of photography as well.
So we're just about out of time, so I want to ask you one last question. What's the most important lesson about life that you've learned from photography or from working as a food editor?
Seize the day. Don't wait.
Elaborate.
when you're dealing with photography, and obviously not studio photography, where the food is just going to sit there on the table, although it can degrade with time, if you don't have the camera with you, if you don't take the picture when the moment presents itself, it's a lost occasion. So you really just have to go out and do it and believe in your ability to capture it when you can. If you don't like it, first time you look at it, sit on it, come back to it a week later, 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later. But you just have to seize the moment, because if you don't, you'll never have the chance to look at it 3 weeks later.
I love it. Well, I'm glad we seized this moment and scooped you up yesterday to come on the radio show. So thanks for being here, Christina.
Thank you for having
me. And for everyone listening, you can check out Christina at ChristinaGill.com, or you can read her column every Friday on Design Sponge called In the Kitchen With. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.